Hi everyone, and welcome to a new episode of Swisspreneur. Today we're going to have a chat with Daniel Gutenberg, probably the most successful angel investor on the planet. He already invested in 12 unicorns and there are still more to come. He will talk about how and why he became an investor and will also tell us his secrets, how he finds unicorns. Additionally, he also compares the startup ecosystems of Israel and Switzerland. Let's have a chat with Daniel. Before we get started with the episode, I would like to introduce you to SBB Startup. If you think that your company is a good fit for the Swiss Railways, get in touch with them or learn more about their startup programs at sbbstartup.com. So Daniel, thank you very much for taking the time and welcome to this episode of Swisspreneur. It's a pleasure to have you here today.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you very much.
I would like to start back in 1987 when you first moved to Hawaii to work as a surfing teacher there. You said in an interview that you arrived there and you saw the big houses and then realized that these big houses there belonged to the local entrepreneurs, or at least most of them. What feelings did that sort of trigger in you, or what desires did that trigger in you when you first realized that probably the most wealthy people in Hawaii are entrepreneurs?
Well, of course, not only in Hawaii. I think the most wealthy people of the U.S. Are having houses in Hawaii, if it's not the Hamptons. Hawaii is and also the most wealthy people of Japan. And end of 80s, a lot of Japanese were very rich. So really nice houses. I was doing $5 an hour and, of course, aspiring to one day be able to live in a house like this. I think that's quite inspirational. Yes.
What was this inspiration to, you know, to get on the way from $5 an hour to be able to afford these big houses? What was the pure motivation there? Was it sort of an achievement that you wanted to have for yourself, or was it?
I just liked it and I looked at it, but it wasn't like I couldn't sleep because I really need to, pursue this goal of having a big house. Sure. It wasn't my first goal. If it would have been my first goal, I probably would have not continued as a windsurf instructor, mm-hmm. a job I really loved and did for fun more than for earning money.
Absolutely. Then 4 years later, in 1991, you moved back to Switzerland, where you also started your first company when you were just 25 years old. You were a reseller of US soft and hardware in Switzerland. How did you start that company at such a young age, and what were probably also the challenges that you faced then?
Yeah, so when I moved from Hawaii to Switzerland, I got hired by a Swiss company that was a distributor of Everex Computers, a Californian company. So I worked there for a year. And the company merged with another company, and my job was made redundant. A very nice expression. So I was out of a job, and I was expecting people to offer me a job, as always happened before, mm-hmm. but nobody did. So instead, I just started my company.
So sort of out of your own need, you just said, hey, if nobody's hiring me, I just start my own company.
Exactly. And I didn't, make a big fuss out of it. I just started working here a little bit, there a little bit, and then it just happened to be a company at the end. It wasn't really very prepared.
You also were very well known for, checking out exhibitions and looking for products that you understood in 30 seconds or less. Was that also a part of your successful business start back then?
Absolutely. I was looking for new products to distribute, and to be efficient, I would walk very fast through the exhibitions, so it wouldn't leave me more than 30 seconds to understand the booths I was looking at, and I thought it only makes sense to distribute something that people can understand very fast, because that will make it easier to create the demand.
Absolutely.
And so I would walk through in a very systematic way through all the booths and would only stop where I could understand right away what they do, and then maybe inquire further if they need a distribution ship in Europe.
How did you prepare for these exhibitions? I think you also had to do a certain homework.
Absolutely. I knew the market. I knew my, what I want, what other people want to have as new technologies. And I would look at, I get the books from the exhibitors directory beforehand. And then I would go through the book and research about all the companies and all the, often you have also different halls with different teams. I would research a lot beforehand, before going. So I would, be in the know when I'm there.
Then 3 years later, after you started your own company, Gutenberg Communications, one of your major suppliers went bankrupt. Walk us through that?
So that was not one of them. That was the major supplier of my main product, which is a portable hard disk. I was importing it from the US, doing a great business. I basically was like a subsidiary of the company in Switzerland. I was distributing it to dealers. I was even sub-distributing it to other distributors and was doing the support and the marketing, printing my own material in German and in French and in Italian, and hiring people to do the sales, to do the support and everything. And one day, and numbers were going, 5 or 10% months over months upwards, really good.
Very startup-like growth.
Yeah, it was a startup. and everybody needed more hard disk space. Windows 3.0 came on the market. Everybody needed more space. And so one day, the guy told me he couldn't deliver anymore because he was bankrupt. And I just couldn't believe it because it was such a good product and such a good margin. So I was very surprised. In my head, I thought I was doing 1 or 2 or 3% of his worldwide turnover. So next day I traveled to the US, met the guy for the first time. He, picked me up at the airport and he said, "Hey, Daniel, I'm so sorry, but, you were like 80% of my turnover and just wasn't enough to, keep up, the factory and the costs for the research and development." So I realized that I really made a big mistake by not knowing this guy's or this company's numbers. Mm-hmm. And that made me decide that for every future company or dealership or product I would distribute, I need to have at least a share of the company. So at least at the end of the year or maybe several times a year, I would get the numbers and be aware if the company is sustainable or not. So the next three companies I dealt with all became multi-billion dollar startups. That was Netscape, Netscreen, and Intershop.
And that's pretty crazy if you think about that, how that actually turned out.
That was a big coincidence, really, that all three of those became such big, strong companies. And particularly Netscape helped me really to make to become the go-to place for every software vendor that wanted to have distribution in Europe.
I think it's a pretty difficult question to answer, but from your perspective, what percentage would you say is like timing or coincidence luck, and what percentage is also skill, or is that very interconnected and has to come together at the right time?
So, well, the part about connections, I would not agree because I didn't have any connections. The part about luck is to be, in the internet area when the internet starts is, of course, huge luck. The same thing would not have happened in any other industry. Like, really the internet took off like crazy. And the third part, skills, is because I read a lot and I knew what's going on in the market. And when I read about Netscape, I told my assistant to write them a letter and to tell them that I would like to represent them in Europe. And they were so small then, they didn't really care. They're like, well, if we can do some more turnover in Europe, why not? Just, take care of it. Just don't bother us too much. So it was really easy to get the relationship and the distributorship. I guess I was pretty much the only guy who even wanted it at the time.
You also mentioned the companies that you got in touch with, and therefore also you met very now famous people like Marc Andreessen, Larry Ellison, but also Jeff Bezos, for example. How did these meetings happen, and what did you take away from these people? Did it feel any special to meet these people who are very famous nowadays?
Yes, I think those people already at that time were kind of famous in the US, not that much in Europe. It was very, very special for me to meet them. I was in my mid-20s, and they were a bit older, most of them. I met them through an organization called YPO, the Young Presidents Organization. Without this organization, it would have never been possible to meet them.
Maybe you can quickly explain what this organization does.
The Young Presidents Organization is a global organization of presidents or CEOs of companies. The companies have to have a certain size, so before that you cannot apply to become a YPO. Mm-hmm. And the tagline of YPO is better presidents through education and idea exchange. And they organized what they call a university, which is a one-week meeting, different places of the world with different agendas and different topics. And they did in 1996 organize a university in San Francisco, and the topic was IT, and I attended that university, and that's where I met all of those people.
And how did that feel? You know, you said they were already pretty famous back then. What did you take away from these meetings? Did they inspire you in a certain way?
Absolutely. I met there not only those names that you just mentioned. I also met a guy that really influenced me, John Doerr. He's one of the leading venture capitalists in the Silicon Valley, but a name that not many people know. He's behind some of the companies like Sun Microsystems, and he had a very interesting lecture. A very bright guy. He impressed me a lot, and I just had a real big advantage in comparison with my peers in Europe, by knowing what those guys were thinking and which direction those guys were running, which here in Europe nobody had realized yet.
Do you see, I think this is a very interesting topic, do you see something like that happen nowadays, where somebody thinks further ahead or sees trends coming up that we maybe in Europe don't see coming yet?
I think there is places that have that are further advanced than others. I would say that Israel is one of those places that has in many, especially cybersecurity, but also in autonomous cars and stuff like this, an edge and the ecosystem that has that is years ahead of the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. You could also argue that Switzerland has that for blockchain projects. We have now more than 600 blockchain-related companies that came to Switzerland or started in Switzerland. So we have quite of a hub here. So there are certain hubs like this, but of course, today information is circulating much faster, much more freely than it was in the 90s. So I think the effect is not as strong anymore.
Then now going back to your company, Gutenberg Communications, in 2000, you sold your company. Also with a pretty good timing before the dot-com bubble hit the market. What made you sell the company?
Well, I didn't sell the company. I really didn't sell the company. I didn't want to sell the company. I got a phone call from a headhunter. Actually, a letter from a headhunter that said that that he works for a company that would like to have me as a CEO, and I threw the letter in the garbage. And he called me back and back and back. And my assistants one day said, "You know, I can't get rid of this guy."
Persistence is key.
He was very persistent, and so I took the phone for the first time, and he told me that he would like. He's really mandated to get a CEO, and I told him yes, but I'm not free. I have my own company. He's even got my name, so I there's no way I can leave. And then he said, yeah, but the guy would also buy a company just to get the right CEO. And I said, well, but it's a huge multinational company. I totally exaggerated. And he said, yeah, but still, he would still be interested. So I told him on the first phone call, I told him, well, if it's like this, this is the price. You go back to your boss and tell him the price. And if he still wants to meet me, he can meet me. And so a month later, I met him. I think 3 weeks after that, he wired the money. And I told him he can do the due diligence afterwards. First, wire the money. And he did that. It was pretty crazy.
That's crazy. And really, you know, like not how these things usually work.
Absolutely.
So to sum that up, you were in a pretty good position where you said you have a well-running business. Your name is on the door, basically. And you have no need to actually sell it. So you just named the price where you thought, hey, let's go crazy.
Exactly. I just named the price that I thought was unreasonable. There was no other, I never offered the company to anybody, so there was no other bidders or anything like this. It was just this one company, and they ended up buying.
Cool. And then what did you do afterwards, after the deal closed?
So after the deal closed, I became CEO of that operation, I worked for a while. Unfortunately, the boss, the guy who bought me, it was a public company, but very run around one guy, and this guy died. Maybe a year later. So the whole thing was completely different after he died, and I decided to leave the company.
And was that also the time when you started to focus more on being an investor?
Oh, not at all. I focused on doing some vacation, which I did for like 3 years.
Right when the dot-com bubble hit, right?
Yeah, exactly. So, well, the dot-com bubble went, you know, broke about 3 months after I sold. So I sold in March, and in the summer, everything went
talking
berserk.
About good timing.
So yeah, it was good timing, but it wasn't really my timing.
So this was more lucky. A coincidence because you had an opportunity.
I was absolutely lucky. I really had no idea that was coming. I just knew that the price I was asking for the company is more than fair.
Then after vacation...
And after vacation, I started to work as a venture capitalist for Venture Incubator. It's a Swiss venture capital company that has 10 investors, large Swiss companies, Nestle, Novartis, Credit Suisse. They asked me if I wanted to be part of the team. And I said, yes, I'd love to do that. I just can't do it 100% of the time. Because I have global interests and this company only invests in Swiss companies.
Okay.
So in 2003, that was, I started for Venture Incubator. And since I was then a venture capitalist already, I also continued to do my business angel deals.
How did these two activities support or even positively influence each other?
Yeah, it's a good question. Many venture capital funds, you know, prohibit their investment managers to have private investments. Mm-hmm. For me, it was a condition, and I think it's all in the advantage of the fund if the investment manager has skin in the game and is invested himself. He will, you know, take better care of the investments. And maybe also better care to find good investments. So for us, that has worked. I mean, you would have to ask the LPs, but I think it has worked very well. There is, you know, potential for conflict of interests. But I think if you're very transparent and open, which has always been, you know, I always try to be as transparent and as open about what I do as possible, the advantages are much higher than the disadvantages. Mm-hmm. So, of course, I try to do everything in parallel with the fund. I try to offer everything to the fund before I do it. Stuff like this, which is, you know, common sense.
What actually made you make that decision to come out of vacation? Because probably after you sold your company, you could have very well also just, you know, relaxed on the beach a bit longer if you wanted to.
That was the initial idea, that I was done with working forever. But after 3 years, I got really bored. I really had troubles motivating myself out of bed in the morning. Mm-hmm. I would show up late for lunch meetings because I needed to take a shower first. And I realized that I had nothing interesting to tell anymore to anybody. It really was boredom that made me go back to business.
So this is I think this is a very interesting statement. So you had quite a lot of money that you made from your company sale, but there was something else missing to have a fulfilled life, and that was sort of a meaning or interesting things to do or to talk about.
Absolutely. Money alone doesn't make a fulfilled life.
Talking about money, one of your first investments was Mobileye, which became a huge success and was sold to Intel for $15 billion. I don't know if you are able to answer this question or willing to answer this question, but as an early stage investor, you have been in such a case. What is like the financial result for you as an investor in such a huge success case?
Well, it was a positive result. That much I can say. It was a positive result. I was a small shareholder in the beginning, mm-hmm. and I became smaller on the way as hundreds of millions of dollars came into the company from other investors. I would get diluted on the way. But I still ended up with having a good part of it and a very nice exit.
And that's also, I think, nice to see if one of your bets actually pays out, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. And luckily not the only one.
You have 13 unicorns in your portfolio nowadays, I think.
And exactly.
Probably the number is still increasing.
Well, I found 13 unicorns in 20 years of investment. I don't have them all in my portfolio anymore, like Mobileye is out of the portfolio since
sure.
I sold it.
So, or let's say you touched 13 unicorns with your portfolio in the lifetime of it.
Exactly. So yeah.
You also said in an interview that your goal is to find unicorns when they are still below 10 employees, which is an incredibly hard thing to do, but you've proven it over and over again that you can successfully do that. What are you looking for, and what makes a company with below 10 employees a unicorn?
So that I don't think we have time to really explain all of that here. There are certain things that you learn over time, and there are certain things that are obvious, and there is a third part of criteria that is totally unobvious, or the opposite of obvious, how to find. At the end of the day, what I'm looking for is unicorn CEOs, or capable CEOs that can bring a company to a unicorn status. One of the funnest and little criteria that I can give to this video is I always ask the experts in the field before I make an investment in, let's say, life sciences or deep technology or mm-hmm. car or cybersecurity. If the experts have a strong opinion against it or whatever, what I say is I listen to the experts and then I do the exact opposite.
Okay.
Because if you want to find a unicorn, it's clear that this person has to do something completely different than everybody else. Mm-hmm. You can't make such a big jump in front of everybody else if you think the same. You really have to think opposite. So if you think about it, at the time where Nokia was the world market leader in phones, they would say, yes, those guys in Cupertino, Apple, they know how to do laptops and PCs, but they have no clue about the phone business. That's, where we are strong, and we have hundreds of people in research and development, and they have no chance to, we tried everything that there is to try. And of course, the iPhone came, and Nokia is nowhere anymore. Mm-hmm. And the same, happens always in this kind of companies. Tesla comes with electric cars, and everybody tells me, nobody wants electric cars. It's we only do that for tax reasons, but nobody really wants electric cars. And they're completely wrong, because it's not electric, but he found a little secret that people want digital cars. and digital is not the same as electric, and people have a hard time, especially in the automotive industry, to understand what is the difference between digital and electric. So this happens all the time again, and if you see somebody from the industry, it's pretty clear that they think the industry experts think that there can't be somebody coming with a much, 10 times or 100 times better idea, because else I would have seen it. I've been in the industry for so long. But actually, that's how unicorns are born.
But I guess after you found something that you disagree with the experts or that they say you shouldn't do, your job is not done there. Because once you have identified to do the exact opposite, you still have to distinguish between the cases that have the potential to become a unicorn and those who are just not going anywhere.
So first of all, it's not my ideas. It's never my ideas. I just, look at the ideas of others and then I try to judge if they're good or not. Mm-hmm. I don't develop my own ideas, which unfortunately I'm not capable of. So I see those entrepreneurs coming up with these ideas, and then I, have to judge if it's possible or impossible, and if it is possible, if it makes sense or no sense, and if it makes sense, if there is a market for it or not. And pretty much if I can answer those three questions, then I will look around if it's really the only ones that have this idea.
You also mentioned the importance of the CEO, a unicorn CEO or a CEO capable of bringing a company to unicorn status.
Yeah.
What are the traits, the characteristics of such a good CEO?
So it's somebody that really lives for his idea, that eats, sleeps and drinks the idea he's talking about, that has skin in the game because he has to, have success, be it because he's driven by his product or by proving the world around him that he can have the success. Mm-hmm. And somebody that is super efficient, somebody that can create a distorted reality. I think Isaacson, talked about distorted reality fields that Steve Jobs has built around him. And the same is true for all unicorn CEOs. They are able to, to project the vision in a way that everybody around them sees it as reality. Mm-hmm. But in reality, it's not reality. It's a vision. So it's a distorted reality. But if you are able to project that, to your employees, to your partners, to your customers, then you create something very powerful.
You said you have to eat, sleep, and drink the idea sort of 24/7. Are you looking for more younger founders? Because, if people are a bit older, they also tend to have a family and might not be able to have the same time, investment, and commitment.
Absolutely. So, yeah, very typically, my founders are very young. Mm-hmm. The exception to that is that the older I get, also the older my my founders get. And many of those I have backed, already two times or three times before, and I back them again because I know how they learned and how they act.
Did they have to succeed before you back them again, or have you also backed people or founders who have not succeeded?
I also have backed people who have not succeeded. I even have backed people where I said it's not going to work, but next time around I really would like to be your backer.
What specialty made you say that? What made you let you do that conclusion to with that person?
Yeah, the other 100 criteria that I use. So people have to have some some kind of a charisma, some kind of a charm, but also have to be super efficient with what they do. Mm-hmm. They have to be super efficient in the use of technology. They have to be good communicators, good analysts, structured thinking, good technologists. So there's a lot of criteria. And if I see that, somebody is having all of this together, then I see some potential.
You also mentioned skin in the game. Does that mean that the founder has to invest money personally into the startup?
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. Doesn't have to be money. If he doesn't have money, it can be time or sweat equity or whatever. But he has to. I never invest in somebody that does it just as a hobby.
That's probably set up for failure anyway, most of the cases.
Yeah, very often.
I also read a very interesting story about a very interesting case that you did not invest in. You were in Silicon Valley with a Swiss delegation, and there was, I think it was the founder or the CEO of a pretty famous company nowadays that pitched you on a bus ride.
Yeah, so the story started early. The story started in Switzerland about 3 weeks before we go to the Silicon Valley with a whole group of investors out of Switzerland. I see this app and I read about this app and I download this app and I try this app and I absolutely loved it and knew from the first second that's going to be a huge success. So I called up the organizers of the trip and said, hey, there's one more startup we need to look at collectively as investors. Mm-hmm. And they told me it's not possible because we are fully booked. Nobody else can present. I said, no, you don't understand. This one is really special. We have to see this one. and they said, no, it's not possible. And then I realized that from one venue to the next, we were taking a bus. And I told them, well, he could present in the bus. So they couldn't really say no. So I invited him to present in the bus. And I tried it as well. There was only two cars in San Francisco at the time, mm-hmm. two Ubers and this app. And the founder of Uber presented in the bus. To us, and at the end of the day, we forgot to invest.
I think Florian Schweitzer mentioned that there was no proper follow-up happening afterwards.
Exactly.
And so you sort of didn't use the investment opportunity that you probably might have had.
Exactly.
Are there any other cases that you wish you had invested?
Yeah, I looked at Skype very early on, and they already wanted a two-digit valuation. And I told them, if you're below two digits, I invest right away. But they never called me back, so.
Too bad.
Yeah.
All these descriptions, you seem to have a very, very good feeling and eye for when the timing is right and about the potential of a tech company. Do you, when you evaluate them, do you have a very specific like Excel sheet or anything where you do your rating, or is this more based on your experience and also gut feeling that comes to an overall conclusion afterwards?
Yeah, I sometimes wish I had this Excel sheet, but I'm not a very structured nor analytical person. So it's all experience and gut feeling and, being doing it for a long time.
And I think that turned out pretty well so far.
So far it works, yes, I can live.
Mobileye was also your first Israeli investment. How did you end up investing in Israel?
Oh, there was a poor coincidence. The Mobileye guys, the founders, were traveling on a ferry boat from Italy to Greece with their mobile home, and my brother had the mobile home next to it. And they started talking to each other, and my brother recommended to them to come to Switzerland and show me the idea, which they did, and I immediately invested.
Cool. Again, great story with the little coincidences that the world has laid out for us.
Yes.
From your perspective, what can Switzerland as a startup ecosystem learn from Israel in that regard?
So I don't think I'm at the right place to give recommendations, but I can tell you the differences. And one of the differences is that in Switzerland, our talents have been hired away by large companies, mm-hmm. Credit Suisse, UBS, Nestle, Novartis, World Health Organization. We have so many very large companies here that pay very high salaries to people directly after university that the whole notion of being an entrepreneur has not such a big sexiness, I would say, in Switzerland as it has in Israel. In Israel, there is, of course, no such large companies, at least no headquarters. Mm-hmm. And being an entrepreneur is on top of the mind of all the students, and that's what they strive for, and that's what they look forward to. So, so of course, naturally, you get the best talents working on startups, which in Switzerland wouldn't be the case.
Do you think that comes from role models, or where does that come
from? It's role models, it's education, it's cultural. I think there's a whole, you know, there's also the army that plays a strong role in Israel.
Absolutely.
Young people in the army in Israel get, you know, to lead in life and death situations. They get to lead when they're 18 years old. They get to lead 4, 10, 20 people in very dangerous situations. So they really become leadership skills way earlier than people in Switzerland will get leadership skills.
And they also have a very strong focus on technology and cyber defense in the army.
Absolutely. They have this unit 8200 that is dedicated to technology. And within that, they have another more highly specialized unit called the Talpiots. And many of the startups come out of those two units.
What do you think, on the other hand, Israel could learn from Switzerland, startup-wise?
So, what we have in Switzerland startup-wise is we have very good technologies, very good patents, very good universities. We have a pretty good accessible government. We have a very stable system for legal system, so that really protects your rights. We have more or less sensible tax system. We had this problem in Zurich, but I think it's kind of solved now. So there is advantages in Switzerland. I think that there is a reason that now the whole world is looking to move their blockchain companies to Switzerland. So that's good. What we are missing a little bit is CEOs that have the courage to really do crazy things.
In what regard, crazy things?
Yeah, in the regard of finding a unicorn. Huh? Basically, there is no unicorns in Switzerland. You know, number one unicorn country today is China, not the US anymore. And Israel, a country half the size of Switzerland, has half a dozen unicorns, whereas Switzerland has zero.
I think there's also a big difference in how startups actually perceive a market. In Switzerland, most of the startups, they want to start in Switzerland and don't really think how to go international from day one. While this seems to be a bit different in Israel, do you also think that this is a reason why there are more unicorns in Israel?
No, absolutely. Absolutely. In Switzerland, you can make a business out of Swiss customers because there's so much money around. In Israel, there's no way. I mean, there's absolutely no way to even think about it to make a business out of just the Israeli market. So Israeli startups think, you know, Europe, US or China right away at the start.
You also mentioned crypto and blockchain as technology. You are pretty bullish on that technology and also involved in the crypto finance conference, for example. Where do you see the future of the blockchain technology, but also crypto assets in general?
So I think crypto currencies and blockchain technologies are going to change the world as we know it. It's going to be a very large move and change, similar to the internet. Only started, you know, the paper was written 10 years ago. The industry started maybe 5 years ago. So it will take some time. People tend to forget the credit card was invented 30 years ago, but only started to become used about 5 to 10 years ago. Largely used, or widely used, and so it took more than 20 years until it took off. And I expect the same to be true for blockchain technologies. It's going to take 10 to 20 years to really take off. So we are in the very beginning. I frankly don't know which, you know, projects and which technologies and which companies will win the game. I wish I did, but the only thing I can do is watch from very close, and that's one of the reasons, or the reason actually, I invested or co-started the crypto finance conference with my friends, is to be very close to the market and to be listening and looking and rub shoulders with the guys who are working in that field.
Absolutely. I think there's a very interesting future ahead of us in that regard. I
totally agree.
To conclude this episode, I would like to ask you about your favorite tools and gadgets. Is there anything that comes to mind when you have to choose your favorite gadget or tool that you use on a regular basis?
Too many to mention, probably. But I would say my favorite, I think that is totally underserved, is that I hate keys. And I try to install everywhere that I can electronic keys to open doors. So my house is completely controlled by phone. My car I can open by phone. And several of my companies that I'm invested in, the doors locks have been replaced by locks that are that you can open by phone. And the advantage of that is, of course, you can send out the keys by email. And you can delete keys by email. As I told you before, I'm not very structured, not very, I'm a bit chaotic. So whenever somebody gives me 10 keys to a house, within 1 year, there will be only one key left and I wouldn't have a clue who has the other nine.
So I see that there's a certain pre-good condition for startups that want to get investment from you.
Maybe. So I'm invested in one of those companies called UniKey or Kevo, and they produce these electronic keys in Florida.
Fantastic. And my last question, you mentioned that you are reading a lot. Are there any resources like books, blogs, or podcasts that you can recommend to our listeners?
Yeah, so I would say my main lecture for the last 5 years has been TechCrunch. I also look at Crunchbase. I look at Mashable, Wired, this kind of blogs.
Fantastic. Daniel, it has been an honor to listen to your thoughts and hear your insights. Thank you so much for taking the time today.
Thank you.
And we'll see you again in the next episode when we talk about early stage fundraising.
It'll be a pleasure.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of Swisspreneur. If you have any feedback or points we can improve, please let us know and send us an email to info@swisspreneur.com. If you liked what you just heard, please make sure to follow us on social media and sign up for our newsletter at swisspreneur.org. See you next time.